G'day, this is David Rutledge. Earshot is the program, and this is our podcast. Great to have your company once again. This is a story of human endurance and the kinds of choices that we all hope that we'll never have to make. It's about Jess and Ahmad. They're friends in Syria, but when war comes, Jess leaves while Ahmad stays behind. And when they miraculously find each other more than a year later, Ahmad is a very different man. Here's his story titled The Drawers of Memory.
Sounds and scenes like this are multiplying across the Arab world as ordinary citizens continue to rise up against entrenched and oppressive regimes.
I have never thought about leaving my country, and I have never thought about being a refugee or being like residents of in other countries.
Last week it was Yemen, before that it was Bahrain. Now it appears to be the turn of Syria, widely seen as one of the most oppressive regimes of all.
After I almost like being killed many times, I almost like arrested, it was impossible to stay more.
ينطلق صوتي هذه المرة من دمشق. My voice rings out this time from Damascus. ينطلق من بيت أمي وأبي. It rings out from the house of my mother and father in Sham.
But at the end, we didn't die in the sea. So we were a little bit happy and lots of sadness. You left your country. You almost killed yourself just to find a place where you can live, where you can start a new life.
After my limbs have been strewn across all the continents and my cough has been scattered in all the hotels, after my mother's sheets scented with laurel soap, I have found no other bed to sleep on.
Like half of my life is still in Syria. Half of my thoughts every day in Syria.
فبعد شراشف أمي المعطرة بصابوني الغار لم أجد سريرا أنام عليه.
I met Ahmad in Damascus in 2011, just before the uprising began. Damascus is the oldest capital city in the world. The ancient Umayyad Mosque lies in the heart of the old city, a building that is over 1,400 years old. My bedroom sat on the roof of a Damascene house, overlooking the mosque. A bitter orange tree grew in the courtyard below.
The Damascene house is beyond the architectural text. The design of our homes is based on an emotional foundation, for every house leans on the hip of another, and every balcony extends its hand to another facing it. Damascene houses are loving houses. They greet one another in the morning and exchange visits secretly at night.
Each day I walked through the cobbled streets of the old city on my way to study Arabic at uni. The Arab Spring was erupting in Tunisia and Egypt, but the streets of Damascus remained peaceful as locals and foreigners mixed in this ancient city, as they have done for thousands of years.
I enter the courtyard of the Umayyad Mosque and greet everyone in it, corner to corner, tile to tile, dove to dove. I wander in the gardens of Kufi script and pluck beautiful flowers of God's words. And here was my eye, the voice of the mosaics and the music of the agate prayer beads.
In Syria, poetry, storytelling, and public recitals are important. In Damascus, I went to a poetry night called Beit al-Qasid, the House of Verse. Syrian poets, actors, and playwrights attended, as well as many foreigners. Arabic, English, Italian, and French poems were read, among other languages. One night, a poem by Nizar Qabani was read, the most loved of Syrian poets. And the entire room broke out into verse. Everybody knew the words.
A state of revelation and rapture overtakes me. So I climb the steps of the first minaret that encounters me calling, come to the jasmine, come to the jasmine. فأصعد درجاتي أول مئذنة تصادفني مناديا حي على الياسمين حي على الياسمين.
Ahmed and I met on the streets of the old city. We would hang out in cafes speaking a mixture of Arabic and English. We'd sit in their green courtyard sipping polo, a Syrian drink made of crushed ice, lemon and mint.
I remember we went to a small place in the old town and then we drink polo. Yeah, that was funny, that was really nice.
Yeah, and that was the first time we met.
Yeah, this is the first time we met, yeah. And we kept on touch as other friends, Lacey, Jess, and I have lots of friends at the same time. And it was really perfect for like learning and exchange and like knowing other people's cultures. That was like if you are traveling while you are still in your town.
Ahmed would approach young foreign students on the streets of the old city because he wanted to practice his English. With his openness and friendly laugh, we became instant friends.
Sometimes foreigners used to be afraid when we start like talk to them in the streets, or they don't have it maybe in their countries. Like to someone stops you in the street, oh, do you want to exchange languages? Oh, no, I am fine. Because, you know, some people might be just like afraid while they are in the Middle East. They have no idea how like were the lives there and how people treat, how people find friends. It's just different than their countries. We used to hear like they have parties and we just came ourselves, even if they didn't even ask us to come. That was really funny because, yeah, we were just like happy. We were just hanging around these people and they were really nice. Everybody was nice. Everybody was outgoing. So everything was perfect.
But our days relaxing in the enchanting and cosmopolitan city were limited. Politics was something rarely discussed in Damascus when I arrived. But a quiet discontent with the status quo was brewing.
Nobody can talk about Assad. Nobody can talk about his government. Like, everybody is afraid. Families doesn't talk about him in their homes. They don't talk about in front of their children. They don't talk about him about, like, if they talk about him, they talk about him in a good way, even if they hate him.
The protests in Syria began in Damascus last week. They're the first open demonstrations in decades. A state of emergency declared in 1963 bans public gatherings.
Only months after I arrived, the mood began to change. The Arab Spring was creating a domino effect across the Arab world. In Damascus, the whisper began. Could the same happen here? Ahmed was seeing the uprising from the inside. He had grown up in a dictatorship, dreaming of democracy. I saw a once bustling city slowing down. As the tension grew, the streets of Damascus became quieter and more cautious. On Fridays, the day of prayer, protests would begin from the mosques. So we foreigners stayed inside, watching satellite television and waiting. The propaganda changed too. Posters of President Bashar al-Assad multiplied around the city. But instead of the happy and grinning president, we saw a stern Assad, dressed in military uniform.
The hours after Friday's Muslim prayers have become a weekly bloodbath in Syria as anti-government protesters spill from the mosques onto the streets in the grim knowledge that many of them are about to die.
I remember at that time a bus full of people from the secret police came and they shoot at us, and I remember they killed one of my friends and they killed someone else and some people get injured. They just start, like, shooting.
In the biggest protests yet since the unrest began in Syria 5 weeks ago, hundreds of thousands turned out all over the country, from Banias in the west to the capital Damascus and Daraa in the far south.
I remember, like, the guy, my friend, was named Nizar Khatib. I will never forget this man. He was fantastic. We used to play football when we were in school. And I remember, this is the first man I remember who have been killed in the demonstration.
Amateur vision showed gruesome scenes.
They wanted to tell us, like, don't do this because this might kill you, so stop it.
Hospitals were inundated as scores of dead and wounded were brought in.
And that day, I think 100 people or maybe 1 in 1,000 people have been killed in one Friday. And that was a really bloody day.
Hospitals and even ambulances came under attack by government forces trying to stop them from treating the victims.
But nobody, like, thought that's going to happen. Like, from every... Like, there was lots of demonstration around the country, and everywhere, like, more than 3-4 people have been killed.
That Friday marked a turning point for me and the country. Civil war was still some way off, but the increasing violence and uncertainty forced me and many foreigners to leave. It was not an easy decision to make. In the short time I'd spent there, I'd fallen in love with this beautiful city and the people I was leaving behind.
I remember all of the foreigners made a big dinner. And I remember when I came to say goodbye to you, it was, like, really painful. I am losing my friends, everybody is leaving, the country is going to the hell. And, like, I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe I will die tomorrow, maybe I will be arrested, and this is even more worse than being killed.
I flew to Morocco, and the unrest in Syria continued to worsen after I left. As I watched from afar, Ahmed continued to go to demonstrations. He told me they began to meet more often, sometimes protesting every day, in the evenings and early mornings. They used Facebook to arrange their meetings, using euphemisms to avoid being caught. Ahmed and his friends took photos and videos to put on the internet, to show the world what was happening in Syria.
Yeah, I remember, like, after you left, it's a start, like, being, like, worse and worse.
Protests are spreading across Syria and more and more.
But, you know, we have to. Our country needs change. Our country needs freedom. It was really, really bad for the long time.
Following decades of fear and intimidation, Syrian people found the courage to rise up against the Assad dictatorship. The violence was a warning from the regime. It's Assad, or we will burn the country down. But the country was already burning. The more Assad cracked down, the more people wanted an end to his brutal regime.
When they shoot at you, when they arrested you, we used to be really afraid because anytime you might be killed, anytime they didn't used to do anything else than shooting. Like, they used to come without uniform. So you never know when they come, you never know who's going to shoot you.
Dozens of civilians, many of them women and children, have reportedly been tortured and killed in the Syrian city of Homs.
During the first year of the uprising, Ahmed worked as a truck driver. On one trip, Ahmed took a load to the besieged city of Homs, 2 hours' drive north of Damascus. As soldiers defected and civilians took up arms, the army cracked down on the city, turning it into a battleground. Ahmed agreed to take this load because he wanted to find out what was happening there.
And then when I arrived there, it was like, oh my God, it was very, very, very scary.
Amateur video shows gruesome pictures of a makeshift morgue. There's a row of bodies covered by blankets. A grief-stricken man stands beside the dead, his anger evident. Many were found with their throats slit.
I saw lots of tanks coming in and lots of tanks surrounding the houses.
The Syrian state media blames armed terrorists for the bloodshed, but opposition activists say it was the security forces themselves who were responsible.
There was, like, lots of army, and they were, like, shooting at anybody on the street. after like 1 year of driving, and then I lost my job because the street was really dangerous, and the owner of the trucks, they decided to stop working because they lost two of their trucks on the road and the highway. And yeah, and when I lost my job, I joined Free Syrian Army because I cannot sit, I cannot do nothing while they are just coming and kill us.
Back in Australia, I kept in touch with Ahmed. He told me, I'm doing the best to bring freedom to our country. But I had no idea he had joined the ranks of the Free Syrian Army. Like much of our correspondents, Ahmed self-censored his messages, worried about surveillance. The Free Syrian Army began as a group of defected army officers and soldiers. Through 2011, the group gained momentum, and by 2012, a number of high-ranking army officials had joined their forces. Later, the group weakened, and jihadist groups began to take advantage of the chaos engulfing Syria. Ahmed went to the eastern suburbs of Damascus, to a place called Jobar. At the time, the Free Syrian Army had gained control of much of the eastern side of Damascus. Ahmed said civilians stopped being scared of the armed forces and began to fight back. Instead of running, they armed themselves. And the eastern suburbs where Ahmed was were blockaded by the Assad regime, with no food or medicines able to enter.
For its part, the Syrian army promised a crackdown and began sending extra forces into the suburbs. Opposition activists reported raids by pro-government militiamen, who've been responsible for some of the most brutal attacks on rebels and civilians alike. As the regime's come under increasing pressure, its forces have grown more ruthless.
Yeah, and then it's a start to be like, here, Jobar in general, it's start to be like one of the places which is, they cannot come in like this. They need to have tanks or they need to have like a big forces to come in.
In 2013, the Assad regime stepped up its offensive to regain control of eastern Damascus. In September that year, reports began to emerge of a chemical weapons attack.
This was the most sad day in my life. We opened doors, we found lots of families die with their children. I will never forget this. They was sleeping, but they are dying. More than 1,500 people, I remember.
The United States says it has proof that the Syrian regime used sarin nerve gas to kill more than 1,400 people.
I had effect on my eyes. In the middle of the day, I cannot stand, I fall down.
A warning, this report contains images some viewers may find distressing.
And one of my friends, his sister and her children, like all of them, they die by the chemical weapons of Assad.
Around the same time, financial support for the Free Syrian Army was blocked off, and Ahmed was asked to become a money runner. Because he was from the centre of Damascus, his ID allowed him to move relatively freely between checkpoints. He told me he would pick up the money from jewellery stores. The cash was in US dollars and euros, and Ahmed would take it across to the rebel-held side of the city. He didn't know where the money was coming from, but he thought it might have been from Saudi Arabia or Qatar. Ahmed says the people he took the money from would take a cut for their services.
I worked with this transferring money to the free places inside Damascus for almost 9 months and with the two of my friends. And actually, like, I always was afraid because, you know, you cannot hide the money, there's checkpoints. So wherever you go, you have to be careful. Everybody is like looking in your staff. So you need to be very smart not to be like arrested. And I used to have sometimes $50,000, sometimes $100,000. I used to hide it in my bands, in like under my clothes. Sometimes I tied it to my belly, sometimes under my armpits. So like every time I had the money, I almost, oh my God, it was really scary. I just wanted to finish it before I get caught. And at the end, they called me from the free side, and they said, you have to skip now because the two friends you used to work with, they are arrested. They already arrested them today. And I called my parents. I said, like, now you have to leave to Lebanon. And they left. And that was fine. But I cannot leave because I don't know if they already have my name in the checkpoints. I was really afraid. I didn't know what to do.
Do you know what happened to your two friends who were arrested?
I don't really know. I have, like, nobody hear about them. But whatever they found money, and I remember they had, like, more than 50,000 euros when they get caught. So, I don't know. I wish if they are fine, but I don't think they are. I don't think they are alive now anymore. And I remember then there was like one man, he was from the Assad's government actually, but he was working with us in a secret way. And I called this man and I told him, like, you can have whatever you want. And I want you to drive me to a place called Az-Zabadani on the other side of Damascus. And I think from that place, I know some people in the Free Syrian Army, they can reach me to the Lebanon border illegal way. I think I was really lucky to skip. It was like more than 9 or 10 days walking every night. I walk 4 or 5 hours. And sometimes some people drive me a little bit on the motorcycles, like just to get on the other side. And then I get to Lebanon.
I lost contact with Ahmed during this time and didn't hear from him for over a year. He told me later, when he made it to Lebanon, he paid a taxi driver to take his passport to the border and have it stamped, so it seemed like he had left Syria legally. He then flew to Turkey, where his family had already arrived. From when Ahmed told them to leave Syria, they didn't hear from him for 20 days. He says everybody was crying. But in Turkey, life was hard and expensive. 2 million Syrian refugees were already there, and Ahmed says Turkey couldn't help anymore. He couldn't work to support himself or his parents.
Turkish people were always fine, were always like nice to us, but at the end, like 2 million people live in Turkey from Syria. There is no more. There is nothing else they can do, I think.
Ahmed decided to make the perilous journey to Europe. As I watched the thousands of Syrian refugees getting on boats in Turkey, I had no idea Ahmed was one of them. He made 2 failed attempts, almost drowning, before he made it to the Greek island of Kos.
It's the middle of the night, and in rough seas, the Greek Coast Guard is pulling migrants from an overcrowded rubber boat onto its vessel.
We were 9, and there was one woman with 4 children. And I remember, like, when the water starts coming into the boat, and we ask him, like, it's not happening, we are not going to continue, we are going to get drowned, like, the waves is really high and you have to go back. And then the children start crying, and I was like, I almost cry, because, like, if we fall down or if we, like, drown, yeah, I can swim with one of these boys, I can hold one of these boys, and the mother can maybe hold one of these boys. Maybe she cannot swim, I don't know. And I thought, like, oh my God, I cannot imagine myself, like, holding one and seeing others, like, drown, like, dying, or I don't know how to describe this. It was really, really scary. It was really, really, like, bad situation.
The moment of relief.
Thank you very much.
Min where?
Huh?
Min where?
From Syria.
Before the recent wave of refugees, it was still possible to travel by plane from Greece to the rest of Europe. Now, refugees must travel overland, walking for days, weeks, or even months. Ahmed says he was lucky to make the journey when he did.
Yeah, I landed in Denmark, and then I took the train to Sweden.
I finally heard from Ahmed after he arrived in Sweden, from his life as a normal guy learning English to a fighter for the Free Syrian Army. Ahmed was now a refugee.
Like, you feel a little bit happy because you made it, but at the same time, it's really sad. You lost your country and now you lost everything in your life.
جئتكم من تاريخ الوردة الدمشقية التي تختصر تاريخ العطر. I have come to you from the history of the Damascene rose that condenses the history of perfume, from the memory of Al-Mutanabbi that condenses the history of poetry. I have come to you from the blossoms of bitter orange and the dahlia and the narcissus and the nice boy that first taught me drawing.
Now I am 31 years old and I have to start everything from the beginning. That's fine, that's okay, but you feel really sad because you know a lot of people still under Assad's bombs. And when I think about these people, I cannot stand myself. I cannot imagine that I am here and these people are. And I don't know, like the world doesn't care. I don't understand this.
So people of Sham, he among you who finds me, let him return me to Mu'taz, and God's reward will be his. I am your green sparrow. People of Sham, so he among you who finds me, let him feed me a grain of wheat. I am your Damascene rose. People of Sham, so he among you who finds me, let him place me in the first vase. I am your mad poet.
I wish if it's going to be okay, like everybody else, I have like some of my dreams, and I wish everything will be fine.
Do you think you will be able to go back to Syria ever?
I will go back to Syria. I think so. I think I will go back. I think freedom going to come to Syria. I can feel, I know these people, I know who I left there, and I know they will win.
I am your fugitive moon. People of Sham, so he among you who sees me, let him donate to me a bed and a woolen blanket, because I haven't slept for centuries. فمن رآني منكم فليتبرع لي بفراش وبطانية صوف لأنني لم أنم منذ قرون.
The Drawers of Memory, produced by Jess Davis, with sound engineer Timothy Nicastri, and the supervising producer was Lorena Allam. And the title of the program, The Drawers of Memory, is taken from Nizar Kabani's poem, and we've put a link to the entire text on the website, abc.net.au/rn. Look for Earshot on the program menu. It's a great poem, very moving. Go and check it out. And that brings us to the end of the podcast. You can subscribe, listen online on your mobile, anytime, anywhere you like. Find us via your preferred radio app, or you can visit us online. Thanks for your company. I'm David Rutledge. Bye for now.
On Future Tense, we'll speak with three researchers exploring change over time, concerning people, identity and attitude. We'll hear how climate and terrain may have affected language, how accents change over generations, and why the food our ancient ancestors ate may have determined our attitudes towards individualism and the notion of community. That's Future Tense, and you can download the program from the RN website, find us via the ABC Radio app, or look for us on iTunes.